Lecture 16. Inferno from Dante's Divine Comedy.
This lecture is about Dante's Divine Comedy, which is by virtually universal consensus the greatest medieval poem in the Western world. T.S. Eliot said about it that he said Dante and Shakespeare divide the world between them and there is no third. Last time we were in Europe was 300 to 500 years ago when we did Beowulf. Since then, a lot has happened in Europe. Europe had absorbed the Germanic immigration and had created the High Middle Ages, which has all the familiar things that we know: Gothic cathedrals, St. Thomas Aquinas, the new universities, the rise of cities and trade and an emerging money economy. One of its greatest achievements, however, still remains this poem, which has engaged some of the greatest minds in the Western tradition. Typically, some scholar will spend his whole lifetime studying some little facet of this work, and at the end of his lifetime, produce a monograph which explicates one little part of that poem. The poem sums up a fantastic amount of medieval learning. I sometimes tell my students that if they have a Divine Comedy with a good index or a concordance, you can look up almost anything you want to know about what the Middle Ages thought about anything, look it up and find what's in Dante's Divine Comedy about it, and have a pretty good idea of what the Middle Ages knew in about the year 1300. And then stunningly, it was not written in Latin for a learned audience, it was written in Italian, so it was intended for a popular audience. The story of the Divine Comedy is relatively simple. There's a pilgrim who's lost in the woods of error, and he can see that there's a hill off there, which if he could get to the top of the hill, he could see where the path was and find his way back. But he's prevented from getting to the top of that hill by three beasts who keep blocking his way. Every time he tries to move, they move and keep blocking him so he can't get to the top of that hill. He's rescued from this dilemma by the shade of Virgil, the Roman poet whose Aeneid we looked at back in Lecture 8. And he says he's been assigned to take the pilgrim on a roundabout way that will restore him to the right path. And it does, in fact, turn out to be a very roundabout way, because his way goes through hell, through purgatory, and heaven. Virgil himself guides the pilgrim through the first two, and Beatrice, Dante's visionary and spiritual lady, takes him through heaven. In the first book, the Inferno, which will be our focus in this lecture, Virgil and the pilgrim descend through the nine circles of hell to the very center of the earth. In the Purgatorio, they climb the nine terraces of Mount Purgatory, at the top of which is the Garden of Eden. There, Beatrice joins them, and Virgil disappears. Then, Beatrice leads him through the nine spheres of heaven. The third book, the Paradiso, ends when they enter the Empyrean, and the pilgrim is granted the ultimate bliss of a vision of God. On this level, the poem describes a fantastic journey, like parts of the Odyssey or parts of the Aeneid. And like theirs, it includes a visit to the underworld. As a fantastic journey, it's a good story. Physically, the hell that's described in this poem is a series of concentric circles spiraling down to the very center of the earth. When they get to the sixth circle in Canto 11 of the 34 that make up this first book, Virgil explains the organization of the place to the pilgrim. The pilgrim says, "Tell me how this is organized. Tell me how this is all arranged." Virgil tells the pilgrim that hell's topography corresponds to the categories of evil as they're defined by Aristotle, the Greek philosopher, in his Ethics. The three main divisions of hell are incontinence, violence, and fraud, which probably also correspond to those three beasts that were blocking the pilgrim's way at the beginning of the poem. Circles 2, 3, and 4, which are near the top of hell, and hence the relatively less serious sins, are the sins of incontinence, that is, the sins of people who lacked control over their own impulses. And this includes categories like the lustful, the gluttonous, misers, and spendthrifts. Circle 7 contains the violent against themselves, against nature, against God, and against their neighbors. That is, violence is further subdivided into four categories in Circle 7. Circles 8 and 9 contain the fraudulent. Fraud is the lowest and worst category of sin. in Aristotle's Ethics, and so it's put at the very bottom here. Those who are guilty of this sin are kept in little separate pockets or troughs, beginning with those who deceived others who had no particular reason to trust them. So thieves and flatterers and hypocrites are here. There are other categories, a little bit worse, of those people who betrayed people who did have special reason to trust them. Here are people who betrayed kinsmen or hosts or benefactors. And then finally, at the very bottom of hell, we get down to the icy floor of hell itself, which contains, for Dante at any rate, the three prototypal betrayers of church and state: Judas Iscariot, the betrayer of Christ, and Brutus and Cassius, who led the assassination against Julius Caesar, each one of whom is in one of the three heads of Satan and is kind of chewed on ruminatively forever and ever and ever. Satan himself is a gigantic three-headed figure who's buried in ice up to his waist. So, one interesting thing we notice already about this poem, that is, although this is the most Christian of poems, hell's structure is Aristotelian. There is some little additional philosophical help that Dante got from Cicero and Virgil, but it is essentially an Aristotelian classification of sins. We also noticed, interestingly, that in every circle of hell, Christians and pagans will be put together in the same circles, punished for the same sins in the same way. The only exceptions to this Aristotelian rule are circles 1 and 6. Circle 1 contains the virtuous pagans, that is, those who led exemplary lives but who were born before the birth of Christ and thus never had a chance to know Christ. And the heretics are in circle 6. Particularly in circle 6, heretics, people who deny the immortality of the soul. These are specifically Christian categories. There's no way that Aristotle could have had categories like virtuous pagans or heresy. But otherwise, the scale of judgment in hell is more philosophical and ethical than it is theological. We might have expected, Dante being the good Catholic Christian that he was, that he would have organized hell according to the seven deadly sins, but he didn't. He organized it according to Aristotle. And that's one reason, of course, why Dante can have as his as the pilgrim's guide Virgil. Because for Dante, Virgil was the kind of a supreme representative of human reason, and in the poem, the nature of evil can be understood by reason without the help of Christian revelation. Therefore, Virgil can make a perfect guide through the nine circles of hell, through the nine terraces of purgatory, and only when they get to heaven does Beatrice have to take over his function. The poem is, as I already suggested, I guess, is intellectually rich, but beyond that, it is also stunningly good poetry. Dante is going to take us to places that we've never seen before, places that we've never imagined before, and what he wants to do is when he takes us to these places, he wants us to see and hear and taste and touch and smell those landscapes and the figures in them. And so he uses similes. Here's another one of those descendants of the great epic similes that were invented by Homer years and years before. And he uses similes comparing the things that we're seeing to things that we do understand to help us see and feel and touch and taste what we're looking at. So in just for a couple of examples, in the seventh circle, there are a group of sinners who meet the pilgrim and Virgil. The sinners are on a burning plain. And they stare at the visitors, the poet says, the way people look at each other at dusk under a new moon, squinting the way an old tailor does at the eye of his needle. In the seventh pouch of the eighth circle, false counselors are clothed in flames, so that standing above them on the ledge above them and looking down into their circle is like, the poet says, being a peasant on a hillside in summer looking down at a valley full of fireflies. Great giants stand in a circle around the first ring in the ninth circle, and looking up at one, the poet says, is like looking up at a great leaning tower of Bologna, which leans toward you, and if the clouds are going the other direction, it makes it look as though the tower is falling in on one. And that impression is enhanced when one giant really bends down to pick them up and sets them down on the floor of the next circle. A pair of lovers in the second circle is whirled round and round in a dark wind. And when the pilgrim asks to speak to two of them, they come floating down, the poet says, like doves with their wings outspread coming toward their nests. In the fifth pocket of the eighth circle, those in public office who embezzled and got rich through graft are put in a river of boiling pitch. And we're told that every so often they try to arc up out of the pitch just to give themselves a moment's relief from the heat. And they look, the poet says, like dolphins arching up out of the water. The sound of lamentation in Hell's antechamber is the sound of sand caught in a whirlwind. The suicide souls in the seventh circle are trapped within trees, and they can only speak when someone tears off a branch. And then their voices, the poet says, sounds like the sap that fizzes out of a green log when you throw it into a fire. There are hundreds or maybe even thousands of these similes in the poem, which is one reason why artists, so many artists have had a go at painting or drawing Dante's hell. Gustave Doré is simply the most famous. There are many, many other artists who've had a shot at portraying Dante's hell. Within these fantastic landscapes, there are some fascinating characters. Two of the most interesting and the best known, I suppose, are Paolo and Francesca in Circle 2. Circle 2 is a circle of the lustful, those people who were carried away by passion into doing something that they knew they shouldn't be doing. They're near the top of hell, so that suggests this is not the worst of sins, and they're with all the other sinners who showed a lack of self-control. In this circle, the pilgrim and Virgil find a dark wind whirling the lovers in a huge circle inside the ledge. We're reminded that in Dante's hell, the state of the lost souls isn't mere punishment, but in some ways every punishment is kind of an expression of the sin itself. Here, those who abandoned themselves to passion in life are swept around by a dark wind, which is, of course, a symbol of that passion itself. We recognize some of the characters in this circle from some of our earlier lectures. Dido is there, Helen of Troy is there, and Paris is there, among others. The pilgrim, watching these lovers whirl around, asks if he can speak to any of them, and Virgil says yes. And he calls out to a pair who come floating down like doves with their wings outspread in that simile that we mentioned just a moment ago. They are Paolo and Francesca, lovers from Rimini, whom Dante's first readers would have remembered because they were historical figures, and their story was fairly recent when Dante wrote this poem and was, of course, widely known. Both were married, Francesca to Paolo's elder brother, and their affair had lasted quite a few years until they were caught en flagrante by Francesca's husband, who immediately killed them both. Francesca, once they've landed, Francesca does all the talking. She thanks the pilgrim for pitying them, and she tells the story about how she and Paolo became lovers. They were alone, she said, reading a romance about Lancelot. When they reach the moment in the story when Lancelot first kisses Guinevere, they both look up from their book, and as she says, their eyes met, and as she famously puts it, that day we read no further. It's a really wonderful story in which Francesca presents herself not as a creature of lust, but as a kind of warm-hearted woman who really had no choice but to return Paolo's love. Besides, she says, everything conspired against them. They were alone. They didn't know the strength of their desire. They didn't know the dangers of the book they were reading. So how could she help but yield? The pilgrim is so touched by her story that he faints when she gets to the end of it, and he wakes up in the next circle. He doesn't even know how he got there. So this is a rich episode. And after we read this, we ask ourselves the question, is Francesca a good woman who's damned for one moment of understandable weakness? Or is she simply a woman who can tell a good story, a story which refuses to see a flaw in everybody else other than herself and who blames everyone else and everything else for what happened? She doesn't tell the pilgrim, Dante's readers would have known this, that she and Paolo were both married, nor does she explain why they were alone or why they happened to be reading that of all books. She isn't in the worst place in hell, and she does note with some satisfaction that there's a place already being saved for her husband much, much lower down. He's going to wind up in the ninth circle, or those who are punished who are treacherous against relatives. In this case, he was treacherous against both a wife and a brother. But she is in hell. It may be a high place in hell, but she is in hell. Adulterous love is socially disruptive and is morally wrong. And it is the result of passion overcoming reason. even though the pilgrim faints in sympathy and Francesca herself seems to be happy to have had a heart so gentle that love could live in it. She and Paolo will be together forever, which is both a triumph of their love and a bitter reminder that each one is there because of the other one. It's an amazing performance by Dante the poet. And this happens over and over again in the poem. Many of the characters we meet in hell have stories to tell, and many of them seem to us, as they do to the pilgrim, admirable or at least justified in what they did. If you want some other examples, consider Ulysses' story in Canto 26, or Pierre della Vigna's story in Canto 13, or Farinata's in 10 for some similar examples. Some critics, and quite a few of my students over the years, have suggested that the kind of sympathy that Dante manages to evoke for these characters works against the moral or Christian meanings of the poem, that our sympathy for someone like Paolo and Francesca works against what should be our theological or moral condemnation of them. I don't think that's quite right, but in order to explain why it isn't right, we have to take a look, closer look at what kind of poem this is. It's really, in effect, many kinds of poems rolled into one. It is a kind of epic dealing with serious issues, and it does range from heaven to hell. Insofar as it is an epic, however, it redefines the epic hero not as a military warrior, but as a spiritual pilgrim. It's also a comedy. That's what Dante himself called it, according to a medieval definition, since it deals with ordinary people, is written in a mixed style, and it has a happy ending. Mixed style means it's not written in the grand style that Homer wrote his epics. It's also a story of a fantastic journey, and as we noted, it's also a kind of poetic encyclopedia, containing much of what the medieval period knew and believed about many things. Much of this material gets worked into the poem in conversation. The pilgrim with Virgil, or the pilgrim with some of the sinners, as they meet along the way, which means that all that other material is dramatically introduced and it doesn't bog down the narrative. But in order to get in everything he wanted into this poem, Dante also made the poem an allegory, which an allegory is really an extended metaphor in which everything inside the narrative is equated with something outside it. And from here on out, I'm going to recommend a book that is very good on this subject, and which I'll be following in part in the next few minutes, by Thomas Bergen, called Dante's Divine Comedy. Medieval theologians had become very adept at reading the Bible in allegorical ways in order to get at all of its meanings. So that when Jerusalem is mentioned anywhere in the Bible, medieval theologians had come to understand that it functions only literally as a city in Judah. On other levels, when Jerusalem is mentioned, it could mean the church, it could mean the heavenly city of Zion, or it could mean the believing soul. In Dante's case, as we read the poem, we keep coming across moments when the poet stops us to say, there's more going on here than meets the eye, if the discerning reader knows how to get at it, reminding us he is writing allegory. There is something allegorical going on here. And in a letter he wrote to a patron while he was writing the Divine Comedy, he says that only the literal level has to do with the state of souls after death. Allegorically, the poem can mean many other things, including what sin does to the sinner in this life, which suggests that on one level, we can put ourselves in hell, spiritually or psychologically, the moment that we give way to sin, which disrupts not only our relationship with God, but with the entire universe. So one of the reasons we suspect why Dante made his hell and purgatory and heaven so concrete and physical is to give it that kind of literal level that Jerusalem has in the example we used just a moment ago. A journey to hell, to purgatory, and to heaven would have been considered literally and factually possible for a believing Christian like Dante, even though he would have been the first to admit that he's imaginatively creating what these places look like. But the poem needs a literal level if the allegory is going to work, and that's, I think, why he works so hard to make us feel and see and touch and smell the places that we visit with him. And it's also, I think, why he peoples his realms with historical figures like Paolo and Francesca, since they have a literal reality that can ground his allegory. In simple medieval allegory, we get characters who are called shame or loyalty or courage or faith. And they have to behave exactly like the abstractions that they are, because they are purely allegorical. They have no independent life outside the abstractions they represent. Dante doesn't use this kind of character in his allegory. He has no one called lust or heresy or suicide. Instead, we get characters like Francesca da Rimini, Farinata, and Pierre della Vigna, historical figures who make his allegorical point. The practice can be risky. A character named Lust can only behave like the abstraction, but Francesca is a real person with a life of her own outside what she represents, so she can be seen by us as an innocent victim, as a soul betrayed by circumstance, as a tragic heroine, as an incarnation of courtly love, all of which might blur just a little bit her theological point. But it also grounds the poem, giving it a literal level more like the historical and physical city of Jerusalem in the example we used a moment ago. And the characters do make the poem far richer and more interesting than it would be without them. Anyway, all of the characters in the book are placed by the topography of hell. Where an individual sinner is and what's happening to him can show what it's like to be trapped by an individual sin without the strength or desire to escape from it. Insofar as we're Christians, or even insofar as we're human beings, we can react to any particular sinner with horror or repugnance or contempt, reactions which the pilgrim has to various sinners that he meets along the way. They get more serious as he gets deeper into hell and the sins get uglier. But we can also react with compassion or sympathy or pity. We can understand Francesca's feeling that she has no control over what happens, that she was simply carried away by love, and we can feel for her. But the dark wind is always there to remind us of precisely what it was that she gave into and the consequences for a human soul capitulating in that way. And just to give you one more example, this is one of my favorites. In Canto 7, the angry and the sullen, who spent their whole lives complaining and moaning and griping about every single thing, everybody was out to get them, the universe is a bad place, they hated everything, they wind up in the bottom of the River Styx. When the pilgrim crosses the River Styx, he doesn't even see them. Just he sees these dirty bubbles rising up through the dirty water, and he asks what they are, and he finds out those same people who spent their entire life moaning and groaning and complaining are still down there doing exactly the same things. They're still doing exactly what they did in life. And so in amazingly precise ways, the placement in hell is not just a punishment, it's also a perfect expression of the sin. These people never enjoyed God's creation or any of his gifts, and they spent their lives in metaphoric mud already. Now they just get to do it forever. The point is that once these characters have been placed in hell and their condition is described, the theological or moral work of the poem is over. And then the sinners can show us some other facets, some other sides of their personalities. In Circle 3, in the Circle of Gluttons, we come across a Florentine named Chaco. His place in hell is to wallow in a kind of filthy and evil-smelling sleet that continually falls from the sky, suggesting the nature of what a glutton does. A glutton appropriates a larger than his share portion of the world's goods and converts it into excrement. We get that from his placement in hell. We don't need any more than that. We know what he is and why he's there. But he also talks to the pilgrim, and when he does, he talks about his city, Florence, and what's happening there. And for a while, we forget about his theological meaning, and we move into history. And Dante has just gotten another topic into his poem, which is, I think, why we miss the point a little bit if we see Dante undermining his own theological points by making so many of the damned souls so interesting. They are, for the most part, real people, and when they are characters from literature, like Dido or Odysseus or Paris, they're so well characterized in their own works that we can still treat them as real people, just the same as if they were historical. They all show the same contradictions in which we all live. They're admirable people in some ways, deserving our sympathy and even of our admiration. But they betrayed their own natures and the purposes of creation by either falling prey to some sin, which is what happens to those in Upper Hell, or they distorted the image of God in which they were created by willing themselves into evil, which is what happens to those in Lower Hell. And because they're so brilliantly characterized by Dante, they linger in our memories long after we finish the poem, and in that way, they force us to think about the meanings that they carry. What about the larger meanings of this poem? Well, there have been so many suggested over the years, so many of them, and I can only suggest a couple of things to watch for as you read this poem. The first one is the growth of the pilgrim as he passes through hell and purgatory on his way to heaven. He learns in the process what it means to participate in evil. Going through purgatory, he learns what it means to cleanse oneself of his sinful tendencies, and then he receives final validation in the light of reality, the image of God himself in the mystic rose at the very end of the poem. The pilgrim is himself redeemed in the process of this work, and he passes that experience along to us in the course of the poem. There are, of course, in the poem, more conventional allegories. The monsters that guard each circle of hell symbolize the sin that they guard, so that, for example, Cerberus, the three-headed dog from classical mythology, can be an allegorical symbol of gluttony guarding that circle in hell. There are also theological allegories. At the very outset of the poem, the pilgrim learns that Virgil has been sent to help him by Beatrice, who was tipped off by Santa Lucia that the Virgin Mary herself was concerned that the pilgrim was lost in the woods of error. In this one, the Virgin represents divine grace or compassion. Santa Lucia perhaps symbolizes or allegorizes illumination. Beatrice allegorizes revelation. And Virgil allegorizes human reason. So that allegorically we can see that reason is alerted by revelation and grace to wake up, to use his God-given intellect to let it carry him as far as it can, and then to let revelation take over and take him the rest of the way home. Virgil himself is a really powerful, rich allegorical figure. He's human reason who can guide the pilgrim through hell and purgatory. He is also the classical tradition, which Dante loved so much. He is Dante's guide, and he's the guide in several important ways. He is, among other things, the one who taught Dante how to write this poem that we're reading. And in other ways, Virgil also represents the Roman Empire, which Dante and other works argued had been a God-created context for the coming of Jesus into the world in order to facilitate the spread of Christianity. And since Dante was also extremely interested in politics, there's a whole level of political allegory in the works as well. As we've said, as we started out by saying, some of the greatest minds in the history of the Western world have spent lifetimes working on this poem. It is incredibly rich, and it probably deserves T.S. Eliot's comment that Dante and Shakespeare divide the world between them, and there is no third. The next time, in our next lecture, we will stay in Europe to look at Chaucer's The Canterbury Tales, which was written about 100 years after Dante's Divine Comedy, but is a very, very different work. It, too, is very much a product of the European Middle Ages, but it has sometimes been called, as in opposed to Dante's Divine Comedy, that is sometimes called the Human Comedy. And with that lecture, when we get to Chaucer's The Canterbury Tales, we'll begin work on a topic that we mentioned in Lecture 12, and that is the topic of narrative strategies and techniques and how stories get told and by whom. We'll come back to all of those topics that we raised in Lecture 12 about frames and framing devices and nesting stories and putting stories inside of stories and how frames can change the nature of the stories, how they get told, and what they mean. Once we're onto that topic, as we said, that will be one of our main focuses for the next two units in this course. Next time, Chaucer's The Canterbury Tales.